you were just, please finish off the story about nearly marrying a...
And this high ranking. He says, the palace is yours. You can go anywhere you like. If you want anything, just ask somebody. And everybody being notified that you are to be treated as an honoured guest. Well, thank you very much. So I wandered off. I come across his garden now. You ever heard of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon? It wasn't quite that, but it's very much like it. The garden there, going out several hundred feet up. Obviously artificial. Now, how do they water? How do they water the Hanging Gardens of Babylon? This is where my amazing, my knowledge of facts and figures often come in. People say, never knew that. How do they water? So this garden, this man married a woman from Middle East, and he was homesick, living in the desert. But he loved her, and she loved him, and he said, oh, you won't be sorry. And he built her. He actually did build the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. There were gardens going up several hundred feet into the air. He built a mountain, an artificial mountain, and put flowers and trees and gardens. How did he water it? Ever heard of Archimedes' screw?
Heard of Archimedes.
3,000 years ago in ancient Greece, a man named Archimedes. He discovered that if you've got a piece of metal, rather like a corkscrew, and turned it, water would climb up it. Mm. You can buy them today, you can get them toys for children. You turn a handle, and water, it puts it going round, water goes up it.
But you've got to...
It's got to be turned. And the water goes up, say, 50 feet to a pool, and there's another Archimedes screw going up to another one and right up to the top. And these gardens were watered. They built a canal, 40 miles long, 18 feet deep. Oh, how wide is it now? About 20 or 30 metres wide. Out in Egypt, going through to the Red Sea. I mean, they'd done some crazy things in those days. People don't realise that we think we're clever. I mean, look at the pyramids. Do you ever start to analyse a little about the pyramids? Not too technically, but the general thing of it.
And just the fact that they just have never been replicated.
And the thing is, this is what fascinates me. The first pyramid, they know when it was built, and had to demolish it. It was unsafe. It was going to crash down. 100 years later, they built the largest thing ever built on this mountain with other else, weighing several million tons, the Great Pyramid. Now, in those days, 100 years was not 100 like a few weeks to us. I mean, our time goes very, very quickly, but their time went very, very slowly. So 100 years, how were they able to go from being so unable to build a pyramid to building the largest building ever? It was the tallest building for over 3,000 years. What building beat it?
Well, I know that one.
Oh, yeah, well done, yeah.
The Eiffel Tower.
That's right. 16 feet higher. Right. And it's only built as a temporary building.
The Eiffel Tower?
Yes.
Yeah. Like the Millennium Wheel.
And like Hyde Park, Crystal Palace. That was going to be demolished in 1851. Mm. Had a great exhibition there. And after the exhibition, they were going to demolish it and smash it up. And Prince Albert said, no way.
Well, isn't it started out in, did you say, just sorry, it started out in Hyde Park, I think, didn't it? And then they moved it down there.
I've been in it many times. They used to have Formula One motor racing, motorbike and sidecar racing.
I think we're talking about...
Crystal Palace.
In the park, not the because the great building burnt down, didn't it? Oh, that's the one, sorry, that you're saying.
Yeah, but in the 30s. I forgot it before it got burnt down.
Oh, sorry, yeah, of course.
So you used to have the circuses there. I love going there. I came out one day and I've been there all day watching a circus, and they're up there 150 feet high, no nets, no wires, jumping off one trapeze to another. I came out and I couldn't get my head down. Mum, I can't get... For 2 days, I couldn't get my head down. It was stuck. And I'm frightened, I tell you. Never done that again. And they built life-size models of the dinosaurs.
Well, they're still there in Crystal Palace.
But completely incorrect. Mm. Yeah, completely incorrect. They found a lot of bones, they just put them together, John, you'll be right, yeah. But it's all incorrect completely. Yeah. But that's who haven't been. They've never attraction for a long, long time, I tell you. Quite frightening.
That's like the in the Horniman Museum. There's a very famous walrus. Is it walrus?
I think
the
it's
one
walrus.
That's the one that's really so the Horniman used to endow people to go and explore and bring back specimens, including a walrus. And
that was a plantation, by the way. You owned a plantation.
It was tea. Actually, that's right.
It was a tea plantation. When he came back, he brought everything back with him, and when he died, he left them to the nation.
But the thing was that the walrus
deflate or something, the net.
Well, it was just that when the dead walrus was given to the taxidermists, nobody explained to them that it was meant to kind of have lots of folds of skin, so they sort of inflated it up as they stabbed it.
Yeah,
so it's like a sort of giant balloon with no wrinkles.
Not nothing gone, is it?
Yes, I didn't. They didn't know. You know, they our knowledge now through archaeology.
Did you ever see Apostle's Clock?
What?
The Apostle's Clock.
No.
At Horniman's. Used to every afternoon at 3 o'clock. It was a huge clock. It was about 12 feet long. And on the hour, the doors opened each end, and the 12 disciples walked in, and bowed to Christ, and they went out the other side.
And they did this.
That was made in somewhere in the Middle Ages. I don't know exactly when. It's called the Apostle's Clock. But they stopped doing it because it was wearing out. Oh. I take my father out there regular. It's a fascinating as a boy. These little steps, 8 or 9 inches high, coming in the door, stopping, bowing to Christ, and then going out the other side. All the disciples there.
So, like a mechanic, because that's interesting, because it's
crazy. I mean, it's. It was a marvellous piece of engineering, I tell you.
In Wells Cathedral, which is down in Somerset, near where some friends of mine live, and that's what there is one of the oldest clocks in the world, and that has a very similar mechanical thing where every hour this thing, I mean, it's been restored now, but doors open and they proceed around and about, you know, amazing.
The Germans are one for that, they're a fantastic ability.
And the Swiss aren't the Swiss supposed to be?
Well, Swiss are more famed for their. The reason why they make watches in Switzerland is because the air's so clean. That's the only reason.
Well, and they've got the know-how.
They have got the cleanest air of any country in the world.
Why is that? Is it the wind?
Altitude. That's simple. I think it's something unusual. And I've won money on this, by the way, so don't argue with it. I go up regularly to Lucian Hospital, and they always want to X-ray me. You ain't got a new X-ray machine in there. Well, no, I'm using it very much. Come on, a couple of X-rays. I thought, right. So I take an X-ray, and then she says, you have to come back, I'll take another one. I said, long lungs. She said, yes. I have got long lungs. When I breathe out, my lungs breathe downwards. Not outwards, downwards. Because my father was born nearly 20,000 feet up in the Swiss Alps. If you go to Nepal, the people of Nepal can walk to the top of Everest without oxygen, carrying their own weight on their backs up a bloody mountain, their own weights, the Sherpas. And their lungs are like that, they are elongated.
Wow.
They don't need oxygen.
Maybe that's how you got away with smoking 80 cigarettes a day then when you were a young man.
Oh, I don't know. It's all very strange. But I've won money on it quite a few times.
That makes sense because I got to know a major who was a who fought in Burma, and but he was quite sickly when he was young. When he was about 17, his mum sent him off to Switzerland, and he stayed there for
It's the best place in the world.
And it kind of cured him.
Tuberculosis. There are hundreds of tuberculosis sanitariums all over Switzerland.
But so there's just the sort of fresh air was thought to do people good, wasn't it?
And during the war, Germany was buying their bomb sites from Switzerland the same as we were. And America was Switzerland was neutral. They'd go there and buy bomb sites for their bombs. We used to go there and do it.
Made bombs.
No, bomb sites.
Ah.
Oh, no, they make...
I was going to say.
Parts of them, yeah.
Swiss Army was only a quarter of a million. Now, Hitler dare not invade Switzerland. Now, why was that? He only got a quarter of a million men, but it's all the army. The army is like a home guard. You do so many days on duty and then you go back to your normal work duties. And in half an hour, they can muster a quarter of a million men.
Why wouldn't Hitler invade?
My understanding of it was that even the Nazis needed somewhere to stash all their loot, basically, a lot of their money.
That might do up to a point, because all the tunnels from Germany to Italy to France all went through Switzerland, and they were all mined. They'd invaded Switzerland, they were pressed the plunger, and all the tunnels had been blocked, and they were the longest tunnels in the world, or were in the day. 8-9 miles long, right under mountains.
Well, they still are. I mean, been through one a couple of years back. It's literally 30 kilometres long.
And then, of course, they then found out they can go to Switzerland, meet British Secret Service people, and I suppose Japanese, and they used to meet there, sit around there and chat and drink together. My dad used to go over there. In the war, my father would go to Switzerland every year. Now, if he drew across the channel, that had shot his plane down. Leslie Howard got shot down coming over, a great actor of his day, because Churchill was booked on that plane.
Not shot down and killed?
Yeah.
Really? Leslie Howard,
yes. Wow. He entertained an actor. He was killed and shot down by the Germans because Churchill had booked a seat on that plane from Gibraltar. But he booked it and never took it. That's how he survived.
So that was the intelligence network.
And they shot the plane down and he disappeared. The band leader disappeared the same way, going across the channel.
Glenn Miller.
I never found his plane, you know. I mean, the channel's quite shallow.
So they never found the body then?
No. But see, why did he take off on his own in bad weather, foggy weather, and disappear?
Was he given a concert? Was he supposed to be here to do a...
There's a lot of supposition. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of quite eminent people who were during the war, of course, who never quite understood how. I've been to his concerts and saw him playing at Bulford. The American station at Bulford, ending in the war. Our station on Salisbury Plain with the artillery. And I used to go down there. And I'd go in their canteens and buy a carton of cigarettes, that's 200, the same price I paid for 20 players. So I went down with a kit bag and stocked up and made myself a nice little profit.
The same thing still goes on. Well, I used to. I lived up in East Anglia for a while and I knew some young lads who worked. I used to go and they played trumpets, these guys, and they shared in a band. Like a proper old brass band. Anyway, they knew people on the American air base in East Anglia.
And then
you go up there and it's literally like a small... It's technically part of America. I mean, once you're on the base, you're off British soil.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they, the stuff, the cheap booze and the cigarettes...
You'd be on the jurisdiction of British people, too.
So these guys would come back with bottles of American whiskey that they bought for a couple of quid a bottle.
Oh, yeah.
Sell it all to their friends and make a big market. Yeah. They're very popular.
I bought a rifle off an American in Burma. I had an old Lee Enfield. Tatty old gun it was. And I'm in this canteen one day and all having a bit of a knees up with some of these gentlemen. I knew a lot behind making officers, once again, through my brigadier. Because he kept in with them because they want to work together. And... So is that a pop gun you got there? It's a bloody good rifle, mate. It's a Ross rifle. The butt is 2 inches thick of foam. Very, very light. And a little over half the size of an ordinary rifle. Telescopic sight. Do you know what a flash illuminator is? Well, if you ever see a gun with a funnel-like barrel, that's a flash illuminator. A Bren gun. If you fired a Bren gun, you're several miles away, you wouldn't see any flashes. Okay. There's a flash illuminator. And fired, unfortunately, 300 ammunition. Now, what size was that? British Army ammunition. 303.
So too big.
Place to be, yeah. Started going around all the American camps, buying up American ammunition.
Well, having bought this rifle won it off him.
And I bought a pair of boots, and their boots, you know, a tongue of a boot. Our boots, the British boots, if you unlace your boot, you've got a tongue there. If you get water 2 inches deep, it goes in your boots. The American tongue is actually sewn into the boot. So if you can go right up to almost your ankle before you get your feet wet. Oh, you're interested in stuff. I'm out there. Some of the equipment I had.
What was the British standard equipment that you were given?
What was it?
What was your British equipment that you were given when you signed up, when you were...
Very primitive, very primitive. A Sten gun was a deadly weapon to the owner. When the parachute was where she was Sten guns, when they jumped out of the plane, as they hit the ground, they went off. There was no safety catch. When you cock a Sten gun, you pull it back and it hooks on a little hook. And when you land on the ground, it jumps out, it starts firing.
And that was a standard gun was given?
They were terrible weapons. The only really good weapon we had was a Bren gun. Now, that was good. That was made in Czechoslovakia. It was invented by someone, a Czech, a place called Bren. And they sent it. I can load that and strip it right down to the last nut and bolt and back again in about 3 minutes. Your father, but it's all of a sudden, and someone shouts out, "Bren gun start!" Off come the barrel, everything. Oh, it was, and the smallest part of the Bren gun, I never got this. With a little tiny piece of metal, about a quarter inch cube. The barrel locking nut retainer spring plunger. Yeah.
No doubt without that.
As it catch you out. Yeah, what we did was, when the barrel got very hot, you took the barrel off and put another one on. It's one of the dangers, firing a gun that's glowing hot. And you had to press a little tiny wee... Well, like a little cube, it must be about a quarter inch cube, very tiny. A little spring held it in place. So barrel locking nut retainer spring plunger. The smallest part of the Bren gun with the longest name. And this is how you remember. My name is Chris doing it, you know.
So but that wasn't part of the standard kit though, was it? I mean if you as your average what we would call squaddy or infantry.
Oh yeah, CO3.
They would
The First World War rifle. But tatty. I never bothered with them.
But that was what they were given to start with, wasn't it? Maybe sometimes in a counter.
They were obsolete.
So First World War guns in the Second World War.
Yeah. Right. Oh yes. My gun was dated about 1920, something like that, 1920, my rifle. My CO3 rifle, I got from Glasgow.
So was it then that, I mean, you know, it's sort of mind-boggling to us now, although I know it's still this problem that the army doesn't always have the best equipment you might think. So this was a problem in Afghanistan with the Land Rovers, for instance.
It's shocking.
It resulted in a lot of deaths, didn't it, supposedly? Because we assume that the government would, of course, they would just provide everybody with the best equipment money can buy.
And they had no helicopters. I mean, I know out in where was it in China, on the China Peninsula, had that long war out there.
The Korean War?
No, not Korean War, no, the, it might have been Korean War. The Yanks had helicopters for every bloody thing. We didn't have any. A man got injured, he had to be carried on a stretcher 10 miles across... Paddy fields to get help. But you know, they got in the old blow there, down the helicopter, in half an hour in hospital.
But so was it the case that, so we, like for instance, though, in the Second World War, that it was a bit like, you know, the soldiers had to sort of, were they issued with new weapons from time to time as part of a new campaign?
What you did, you kept your eyes open and picked up the better weapons that belonged to the enemy. Or anybody else.
But then how would you get the ammunition? Who would pay for the ammunition?
All ways and means, I tell you. If I got, you only got to know one or two people who wouldn't know. And I tell you what, I could have produced a bloody desert tank about 48 hours notice. I'm bloody sure I could have done. I wanted one to a bloody trouble, but it was crazy.
Does it remind me of, I don't know if you've ever heard of a film or a book called Catch 22?
Yeah.
Which is written by an American called Joseph Heller, and it's a satire about the, I think it was, that might have been, it was set in the Second World War, wasn't it? But there's a, one of the main characters there is a fella called Milo Minderbinder, and he specialises in just getting hold of anything.
That's right, I'm a little bit like that, because obviously it's the gunman. First of all, Brigadier, I understand you've got the usual person working with you, sir. Yes, yes, Arthur's quite, he's quite handy. Looks after me well. Looks after me the ladies as well, you know, I look after him, yes. And he's got plenty of drink when he needs it. But he's a nice old bloke, and he'd give me a cushy job. Well, I'm a target, but if you're assassin, if you can kill a brigadier, that's better than we could think of 1,000 men. A brigadier's worth at least 1,000. A brigadier is a man of many, many years' experience, actual physical knowledge of war, and on command, that's 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 men, that's millions of men. So you shoot him and assassinate him, he's worth killing 1,000 British soldiers. And I was there for the gardening. And he wouldn't wear a bulletproof vest, but we couldn't get one anyway.
So what kind of action did you see?
And you never knew. My life in these 6 years was spent advancing 20 miles, retreating 30 miles, retreating 40 miles, advancing 60 miles, advancing another 60 miles, then bun up bloody hell, back up another 30 miles. I never knew where I was. I said, where are we, sir? About 200 miles from Rangoon. Which direction? No idea. You see, there's no street maps, there's no signs that the town, you go through a jungle, you come across a temple. It's been there 2,000 years. I come across one day, there's actually trees, several thick growing through the middle of a temple. And a Buddhist monk came out. He said, I think you're interested. I said, I'm very interested. I said, well, I'm looking at the workmanship here. This must have taken hundreds of years. It's a huge, huge, I mean, it's like Westminster Abbey in the jungle. Love it missing, love it there. But the intricacy of all the carvings of the animals and what have you, and all the sacred figures, it must have taken untold time. He says, you don't mind taking your shoes off, I'll take you on tour. And he spoke good English. That's what kept amazing me. I'll tell you about the funniest one, really shook me. I'm going to the jungle, and a chicken came out of the bushes. Very Danny could have got himself shot. He said, watch him, mate. It's the Burmese boy, about 6, 7 years old. Watch him, mate. I looked at my squad. Correct me if I'm wrong, we are in Burma, aren't we? He said, yeah. Did you hear what he said? He said, yeah. He said, watch him, mate. It turned out he went to a missionary school. And the teacher was a Cockney from South London. Because he'd speak to me, watch your mate, now's your father, and all that nonsense. My mistake. And they were talking Cockney.
Well, I was telling Lorna that I did a couple of years ago, I'd spent a little bit of time travelling in the Far East, and there was, you know, nowadays it's because there are so many backpackers and so on. But yeah, you get these little, it's amazing, these young children would come up to you and would just say, like, you know, I can't think of off the top of my head now, but I mean, well, there's almost, sort of, they'd say, easy peasy lemon squeezy. Was another one that they used to say to us.
They take all the slang and that.
You know, this is a sort of 3-year-old child.
We were warned about the bum boats. When we come to the Mediterranean, the first place to stop at, these boats came out. And there were people there dressed as Scotchmen, with kilts, Tam O'Shanter, with a poor Scottish accent. Okay. But you see, if you want to buy something off me, you've got to send the money down first. Oh, you they won't get the goods, will they? Oh, and we were told not to drink this stuff. It's a hooch. And on board our ship, we got to Valletta. Some men drank some of the stuff, and they jumped overboard. We just didn't drink, don't you, barmy? We can't go back for them. We've got almost 4,000 men being sunk by the Italian submarine because some silly bugger drunk who'd been told not to buy it. They jumped over them, just let them go. A lot of lives are lost unnecessarily, but people are so stupid, they never listen. There's a drink in India, Arak. I remember the name. Now you drink Arak, and you're a good old night out, and you're a few old drinks, and you wake up in the morning, no headache, no hangover. Wahoo! Go out, grab a cup of tea, the first liquid past your drips, and you're drunk. So you get up in the morning, you're okay, you get washed and shaved, you come out, have a cup of tea, go to the playground, and you're drunk on duty. 14 dead in the glasshouse. Havoc.
What's the glasshouse? Is that the kind of punishment block?
Well, that's the military police's depot. Like a military jail, yeah. Okay. Very strict.
So after India, where did you go?
I didn't.
Oh, you spent your time?
Yeah. I don't know if I've ever been in one place more than a few hours. I never seemed to be. I was moving somewhere. I was a wandering gypsy.
How long were you there for? Do you remember the years?
Yes, I went out there beginning of 1943. Yeah, no, middle of 1943. I was about 17 when I got to Burma. Back to India. I was out there until I was 24. So I signed up 7 years with the colours and 3 with the reserve. I signed up for 10 years, 12 years. 12 years, I know it's 12 years. So 7 and 5. So during the 5 years after I came out of the army, they could have called me back for another war had occurred. But it didn't happen that way.
Well, thankfully.
But you see, why did I do that? If ever you know getting down a soldier, ask him his army number. If he starts 144, he's a volunteer. If you're a volunteer, you get lots of little extras. Every year you can change your regiment. You've got fellow's regiment. Every year you're allowed to change your regiment. You can't go home, but you can change your regiment. You get lots of little lots of perks and things, better uniform sometimes. Volunteers, you see.
As opposed to conscripted men.
That's it, yeah. Mm.
Did you ever want to have a life in the army, a career?
I did consider it once, but I saw so much death and destruction. Somehow I just felt that somehow the idea of the army being a good thing was just, to me, no, just an excuse to kill people. So I didn't quite work out my philosophy.
So how did you assimilate from that life to coming back and living in Broccoli?
That was very serious. I came back to England in 1950. I went to Hadrian's Camp, Carlisle. You can see Hadrian's Wall, that camp. I was discharged from there. I came back down to London to a military barracks. I'm not sure where now, Kensington or somewhere like that. And they took me to Epsom in Surrey, you know, to a mental home. I was mentally disturbed. If you'd argue with me or disagree with me, I would have killed you. For no reason at all. If you sort of, you know, threw a cigarette down there, you mustn't throw cigarettes down there. And it's a weapon, I would have killed you. I took me into this place, I spent the whole day there being examined, and they wouldn't take me in. And being Arthur, I said, why the hell not? I thought I wanted. See, you want it, all right. I'm a safety of my inmates. These are all loonies in this place. These are all 35 people, civilians, military, whatever. They're right about their security and safety. It's certainly loose in the public. That's all right. They wouldn't take me into this mental home. I should have had a mental readjustment. Yeah.
It sounds like maybe you had what these days they call post-traumatic stress disorder, yeah. Isn't it? Well, I mean, I think a lot of serving soldiers.
I've been killing for 6 years, and towards the end, I started. As in there, I knew. See, I'm a funny person. Although I was wrong, I knew somehow, mentally, internally, or somehow that something wasn't right. To enjoy, I hated the Japs. So I still hate them, but I hate them for their way of life rather than they know no different. They were told from birth, you were born with only one purpose, to die for the emperor. Every man, woman, child in China in Japan was born only for the purpose of helping the emperor. If he said to a million Japanese people, tomorrow you're going to die, so I need a lot of blood, they would have done it. It would be hardly any dissent whatsoever. They'd been born up for centuries. He was God. He wasn't a human being, he was God.
But I mean, that's the thing, that's the point, isn't it? To expect somebody like you to ask you to do all this stuff as your duty, and you know, you face court martial and so on if you refuse, and then just to sort of expect you to come back to a civilian life is completely
nowadays they go out to Afghanistan for 6 months, they come out 3 months recuperation. That does help a little.
That's because they've learned from
I'd had 6 years. Yeah. Can you try to imagine it? It's new gone 24/7 for 6 years. Every morning, as I woke up, opened my eyes, am I going to die today, I wonder? Not necessarily from any action. Mines, poisonous food, insects. We had no doctors. No doctors. We had a doctor with a suitcase full of tablets, headache pills, and laxatives. That's all he had. No instruments. So if you got shot, they try and get a bullet out if they could, they put a bandage on it. If you could walk, you went with us. If you couldn't walk, we left you. Against a tree with a rifle, a bottle of water, and cheerio. I left a lot of people behind like that. Good friends.
How does that make you feel? How does that make you feel knowing you...
Oh, terrible, terrible.
See, that must be very difficult.
I found it very hard to do. I used to get... After a while, I started allocating someone else to do it on my behalf, you know. So I wasn't really charged. I mean, I did all the ordering around and all the organising and goodness knows what else, but I was only a sergeant. I thought I'd be much, much higher ranking myself. But it's quite surprising, and it amazed me quite a bit towards the end, because I began to realise here was I, an only man, 17, 18, 19 years of age, well educated. I did a very good education. And I'm getting officers coming to me, and old soldiers coming asking me, what should I do about this and do about that? Should we advance on further? And I was always coming up with all crazy stunts, which seemed to work. The one about, you know, we fired the guns, instead of retreating like I normally did, we moved forward half a mile and fired again. And that got chaos, I tell you. And many upstairs accepted. But of course, we would have been in trouble. I did it for a Jed Devilman, you know. I'm a naughty boy.
Well, I mean, I can imagine that, you know, you're in that, like you say, there is so much risk everywhere around you that trying to sort of control it is almost a waste of time.
I was never going to come home alive. I didn't expect to.
Well, that's it. I suppose you might become a bit cavalier.
I lived on bad all the time for 6 years. And then I got very ill one time, and one of the older men, some of the First World Blokes were still out there from... Probably pre-war days. And they've been bunged on to join on run to the regiment elsewhere where their age and experience would probably help some of the younger people. And he said, I think you've got, oh dear,